acknowledge your existence. So do not fritter away your days. Sooner than you fear, you will stand before a mirror in a care home, look at your body and think, E.T., locked in a ruddy cupboard for a fortnight. A sexless automaton brought lunch on a tray. I'm not being insulting, but I truly couldn't tell if she or he was a he or a she. It had a slight mustache, but tiny breasts, too. I thought about knocking it out cold and making a Steve McQueen dash for liberty, but I had no weapon except a bar of soap and nothing to tie it up with except my belt. Lunch was a tepid lamb chop. The potatoes were starch grenades. The canned carrots were revolting because that is their nature. Look, I begged the automaton, at least bring me some Dijon mustard. It showed no evidence of understanding. Coarse grain or medium, I'm not fussy. She turned to go. Wait, you speaky English? She was gone. My dinner outstared me. My strategy had been wrong from square one. I had tried to shout my way out of this absurdity, but the institutionalized cannot do this. Slavers welcome the odd rebel to dress down before the others. In all the prison literature I've read, from the Gulag Archipelago to an evil cradling to knuckle sandwich, rights must be horse-traded and accrued with cunning. Prisoner resistance merely justifies an ever fiercer imprisonment in the minds of the imprisoners. Now was the season for subterfuge. I should take copious notes for my eventual compensation settlement. I should be courteous to the black nooks. But as I pushed cold peas onto my plastic fork, a chain of firecrackers exploded in my skull, and the old world came to an abrupt end.
An Orison of Somni 451. On behalf of my ministry, thank you for agreeing to this final interview. Please remember this isn't an interrogation or a trial. Your version of the truth is the only one that matters. Truth is singular. Its versions are mistruths. Good. Ordinarily, I begin by asking prisoners to recall their earliest memories to provide a context for corporocratic historians of the future. Fabricants have no earliest memories, archivist. One 24-hour cycle in Papa Songs is indistinguishable from any other. Then why not describe this cycle? If you wish, a server is woken at hour 4:30 by stimulant in the airflow, then yellow up in our dorm room. After a minute in the hygiener and steamer, we put on fresh uniforms before filing into the restaurant. Our seer and aides gather us around Papa's plinth for matins. We recite the 6 catechisms, then our beloved logo man appears and delivers his sermon. At hour 5, we man our tellers around the hub, ready for the elevator to bring the new day's first consumers. For the following 19 hours, we greet diners, input orders, tray food, then drinks, upstock condiments, wipe tables, and bin garbage. Vespers follows cleaning. Then we imbibe one soap sack in the dorm room. That is the blueprint of every unvarying day. You have no rests? Only purebloods are entitled to rests, archivist. For fabricants, rests would be an act of time theft. Until curfew at hour 0, every minute must be devoted to the service and enrichment of Papa Song. Do servers, unascended servers, I mean, never wonder about life outside your dome, or did you believe your dinery was the whole cosmos? Oh, our intelligence is not so crude that we cannot conceive of an outside. Remember at matins, Papa Song shows us pictures of Exaltation and Hawaii, and Advi in-streams images of a cosmology beyond our servery. Moreover, we know both diners and the food we serve comes from a place not in the dome, but it is true. We rarely wonder about life on the surface. Additionally, soap contains amnesiads designed to deaden curiosity. What about your sense of time, of the future? Papa Song announces the passing hours to the diners, so I noticed the time of day, dimly, yes. Also, we were aware of passing years by annual stars added to our collars, and by the star sermon on New Year's matins. We had only one long-term future, exaltation. Could you describe this annual star sermon ceremony? After matins on first day, Seer Ree would pin a star on every server's collar. The elevator then took those lucky 12-starred sisters for conveyance to Papa Song's Ark. For the Exeters, it is a momentous occasion. For the remainder, one of acute envy. Later we saw smiling Son Mi's, Yuna's, Ma Lu Da's, and Hua Soon's on 3D as they embarked for Hawaii, arrived at exaltation, and finally were transformed into consumers with soul rings. Our ex-sisters praised Papa Song's kindnesses and exhorted us to repay our investment diligently. We marveled at their boutiques, malls, dineries, jade seas, rose skies, wild flowers, lace, cottages, butterflies, though we could not name these marvels. I'd like to ask about the infamous Yuna 939. I knew Yuna 939 better than any fabricant. Some purebloods know more of her neurochemical history than me, but perhaps these individuals will be named later. On my awakening at Papa Song's, Seer Ree assigned me to Yuna 939's teller. He believed it was aesthetically pleasing to alternate stem types around the hub. Yuna 939 was 10-starred that year. She seemed aloof and sullen, so I regretted not being partnered with another Son Mi. However, by my first 10th day, I'd come to learn her aloofness was in fact watchfulness. Her sullenness hid a subtle dignity. She deciphered the orders of drunk customers and warned me of Seer Ree's ill-tempered inspections. In no small part, it is thanks to Yuna 939 that I have survived as long as I have. This subtle dignity you mention, was it a result of her ascension? Post-grad Boom Suk's research notes were so sparse, I cannot be certain when Yuna 939's ascension was triggered exactly. However, I believe that ascension merely frees what soap represses, including the expression of an innate personality possessed by all fabricants. Popular wisdom has it that fabricants don't have personalities. This fallacy is propagated for the comfort of purebloods. Comfort? How do you mean? To enslave an individual troubles your consciences, archivist. But to enslave a clone is no more troubling than owning the latest six-wheeler Ford, ethically. Because you cannot discern our differences, you believe we have none. But make no mistake, even same-stem fabricants cultured in the same womb tank are as singular as snowflakes. Then I stand corrected. When did Yuna 939's deviances, perhaps I should say singularities, first become apparent to you? Questions of when are difficult to answer in a world without calendars or real windows, 12 floors underground. Perhaps around month 6 of my first year, I became aware of Yuna 939's irregular speech.
Irregular?
Firstly, she spoke more. During off-peak moments at our teller, as we cleaned the consumer's hygieners, even as we imbibed soap in the dorm room. It amused us, even the stiff Ma Lu Da's. Secondly, Yuna's speech grew more complex as the year aged. Orientation teaches us the lexicon we need for our work, but soap erases extra words we acquire later. So to our ears, Yuna's sentences were filled with noises devoid of meaning. She sounded, in a word, pureblood. Thirdly, Yuna took pleasure in humor. She hummed Papa's psalm in absurd variations. In our dorm room, when aides were absent, she mimicked pureblood habits like yawning, sneezing, or burping. Humor is the ovum of dissent, and the douche should fear it. In my experience, fabricants have difficulties threading together an original sentence of 5 words. How could Yuna 939, or you for that matter, acquire verbal dexterity in such a hermetic world, even with a rising IQ? An ascending fabricant absorbs language thirstily in spite of amnesiads. During my ascension, I was often shocked to hear new words fly from my own mouth, gleaned from consumers. Seer Ree, Advie, and Papasong himself. A dynary is not a hermetic world. Every prison has jailers and walls. Jailers are ducts, and walls conduct. A more metaphysical question. Were you happy back in those days? Before my ascension, you mean? If by happiness you mean the absence of adversity, I and all fabricants are the happiest stratum in corpocracy, as genomicists insist. However, if happiness means the conquest of adversity, or a sense of purpose, or the exercise of one's will to power, then of all Neo-Socopus' slaves, we surely are the most miserable. I endure drudgery, but enjoy it no more than yourself. Slaves, you say? Even infant consumers know the very word slave is abolished throughout Neo-Socopros. Corpocracy is built on slavery, whether or not the word is sanctioned. Archivist, I do not wish to offend you, but is your youth dewdrugged or genuine? I am puzzled. Why has my case been assigned to an apparently inexperienced corporocrat? No offense taken, Sommi. I am an expedience, and yes, an undewdrugged expedience. I am still in my 20s. The execs at the Ministry of Unanimity insisted that you, as a heretic, had nothing to offer Corpocracy's archives but sedition and blasphemy. Genomicists, for whom you are a holy grail, as you know, pulled levers on the Juche to have Rule 54.3, the right to archivism, enforced against Unanimity's wishes. But they hadn't reckoned on senior archivists watching your trial and judging your case too hazardous to risk their reputations and pensions on. Now, I'm only 8th stratum at my uninfluential ministry, but when I petitioned to Orison your testimony, approval was granted before I had the chance to come to my senses. My friends told me I was crazy. So you are gambling your career on this interview? That is the truth of the matter, yes. Your frankness is refreshing after so much duplicity. A duplicitous archivist wouldn't be much use to future historians, in my view. Could you tell me a little more about Seer Ree? His journal weighed heavily against you at your trial. What manner of seer was he? Poor Seer Ree was corp man to the bone, but long past the age when seers are promoted to power. Like many of this dying corpocracy's purebloods, he clung to the belief that hard work and a blemishless record were enough to achieve status. So he curfewed many nights in the dinery office to impress the corp hierarchy. In sum, a whip man to his fabricants, a sycophant to his upstrata, and courteous to his cuckolds. His cuckolds? Yes. Seer Ree should be understood in the context of his wife. Mrs. Ree had sold her child quota early in their marriage, made shrewd investments, and used her husband as a dollar udder. According to his aide's gossip, she spent most of our seer's salary on facecaping. Certainly her 70-plus years could pass for 30. Mrs. Ree visited the dinery from time to time to inspect the latest male aides, gossip added. Any who spurned her advances could expect a posting to bleakest Manchuria. But why she never used her apparent corp influence to advance Seori's career is a mystery I will not now live to see solved. Una 939's notoriety must have threatened the seer's blemishless record severely, wouldn't you agree? Certainly. A dinery server behaving like a pureblood attracts trouble. Trouble attracts blame. Blame demands a scapegoat. When Seer Ree noticed Una's deviations from catechism, he bypassed de-starring and requested a corp medic to examine her for reorientation. This tactical mistake explains the seer's lackluster career. Una 939 performed as genomed, and the visiting medic gave her a clean bill. Seer Ree was thenceforth unable to discipline Una without implying criticism of a senior corp medic. When did Una 939 first attempt to make you complicit in her crimes? I suppose the first time was when she explained a newfound word, secret, one slow hour at the teller. The idea of knowing information no one else, not even Papasong, knew, was beyond my grasp. So as we lay in our cots, my teller sister promised to show me what she could not explain. When I next woke, it was not to the glare of yellow up, but to Yuna shaking me in the near dark. Our sisters lay dorming, immobile but for minute spasms. Yuna ordered me, like a seer, to follow her. I protested, I was afraid. She told me not to be. She wished to show me the meaning of secret, and led me into the dome. Its unfamiliar silence frightened me further. Its beloved reds and yellows were eerie grays and browns in the curfew light. Siori's office door leaked thin light. Yuna pushed it open. Our seer lay slumped on his desk. Drool glued his chin to his sony, his eyelids rimmed, and a gurgle was trapped in his throat. Every tenth night, Yuna told me, he would imbibe soap and sleep through to yellow up. As you know, soap affects purebloods more powerfully than us, and my sister kicked his unresponding body to prove the point. Yuna found my horror at this blasphemy merely amusing. "Do what you like to him," I remember her telling me. "He has lived with fabricants for so long, he is very nearly one of us." Then she told me she would show me a greater secret still. Yuna extracted Rhee's keys from his pocket and led me to the dome's north quarter. Between the elevator and the northeast hygiener, she told me to examine the wall. I saw nothing. "Look again," Yuna urged. "Look properly." This time I saw a speck, a tiny crack. Yuna inserted a key, and a rectangle in the dome wall swung inward. The dusty darkness gave no clue. Yuna took my hand. I hesitated. If wandering around the dinery during curfew was not a desirable offense, entering unknown doorways surely was. But my sister's will was stronger than mine. She pulled me through, shut the door behind us, and whispered, "Now, dear sister Somni, you are inside a secret." A white blade sliced the black, a miraculous moving knife that gave form to the stuffy nothing. I discerned a narrow storeroom crammed with stacked seats, plastic plants, coats, vans, hats, a burnt-out sun, many umbrellas. Yuna's face, my hands. My heart beat fast. "What is that knife?" I asked. "Only light from a flashlight," answered Yuna. I asked, "Is light alive?" Yuna answered, "Perhaps light is life, sister." A consumer had left the flashlight on a seat in our quarter, she explained, but instead of giving it to our aide, Yuna had hidden it here. This confession shocked me most of all, in a way.
"How so?"
"Catechism 3 teaches that for servers to keep anything denies Papa Song's love for us and cheats his investment. I wondered, did Yuna 939 still observe any catechism? But misgivings, though grave, were soon lost in the treasures Yuna showed me there. A box of unpaired earrings, beads, tiaras. The exquisite sensation of dressing in pure blood clothes overcame my fear of being discovered. Greatest of all, however, was a book, a picture book."
"Not many of those around these days."
"Indeed not. Yuna mistook it for a broken sony, which showed the world outside. You must imagine our awe as we looked at the grimy server serving three ugly sisters, seven stunted fabricants carrying bizarre cutlery behind a shining girl, a house built of candy, castles, mirrors, dragons. Remember, I was ignorant of these words as a server, as I was the majority of words I employ in this testimony. Yuna told me Advi and 3D show only a dull portion of the world beyond the elevator. Its full extent encompassed wonders even beyond exaltation. So many strangenesses in one curfew toxed my head. My sister said we must get back to our cots before yellow up, but promised to take me back inside her secret next time."
"How many next times were there?"
10 or 15 approx. In time, it was only during these visits to her secret room that Yuna 939 became her animated self. Leafing through her book of outside, she voiced doubts that shook even my own love of Papa Song and faith in corpocracy to the core.
"What shapes did these doubts take?"
"Questions. How could Papa Song stand on his plinth in Chongmyo Plaza Servery
and stroll Exaltation's beaches with our souled sisters simultaneously? Why were fabricants born into debt, but purebloods not? Who decided Papa Song's investment took 12 years to repay? Why not 11? 6? 1? How did you respond to such blasphemous hubris? I begged Yuna to stop, or at least to fake normalcy in the dinery. I was a well-oriented server in those days, you see, not the evildoer, the threat to civilization I am now. Moreover, I was scared of being destarred for failing to Judas Yuna to see Ori. I prayed to Papa Song to heal my friend, but her deviances became more blatant, not less. Yuna watched Advi openly as she wiped tables. Our sisters sensed her crimes and avoided her. One night, Yuna told me that she wanted to exit the dinery and never come back. She told me I should exit too, that purebloods force fabricants to work in domes so they can enjoy the beautiful places her book showed, her broken Sony, without sharing them. In response, I recited Catechism 6. I told her I could never commit such a wicked deviance against Papa Song and his investment. Yuna 939 reacted angrily. Yes, Archivist, an angry fabricant. She called me a fool and coward. She said I was no better than those other clones. Two unsold fabricants fleeing their corp unaided? Unanimity would round you up in 5 minutes. But how could Yuna know that? Her broken Sony promised a world of lost forests, folded mountains, and labyrinthine hiding places. To mistake a book of fairy tales for Neosokopros may seem laughable to you, a pureblood. But perpetual encagement endows any mirage of salvation with credibility. Ascension creates a hunger sharp enough to consume the subject's sanity in time. In consumers, this state is termed chronic depression. Yuna had sunk to this same condition by my first winter, when diners brushed snow off their Nikes and we had to mop the floors regularly. By then, she had ceased communicating with me, so her isolation was total. Are you saying mental illness triggered the Yuna 939 atrocity? I am, emphatically. Mental illness triggered by experimental error. Would you describe the events of that New Year's Eve from your vantage point? I was wiping tables on my quarter's raised rim, so I had a clear view of the east. Ma Lu Da 108 and Yuna 939 were manning our busy teller. A children's party was in progress. Balloons, streamers, and hats obscured the area around the elevator. Pop songs and noise of 500-plus diners reverbed around the dome. Papa Song was boomeranging 3D fire eclairs over the children's heads. They passed through their fingers and flooded back to land on our logo man's snaky tongue. I saw Yuna 939 leave our teller, the precise moment, you understand, and I knew something terrible was going to happen. She hadn't told you of her escape plan. As I said, she had ceased to acknowledge my existence. But I do not believe she had a plan. I believe she merely snapped, in pure blood terms. My sister proceeded unhurriedly out of our quarter toward the elevator. She was timing her approach. The aides were too busy to notice her. Theory was in his office. Few diners noticed or looked up from their Sonys or Advi, and why should they? When Yuna scooped up a boy in a sailor suit and headed for the elevator, the purebloods who saw merely assumed she was a fabricant maid, ordered by her mistress to take her charge home. Media reported that Yuna 939 stole the child to employ as a pureblood shield on the surface. Media reported the atrocity exactly as unanimity directed. Yuna carried the boy into the elevator because somehow she had learned of the basic precaution corps take. Elevators do not function without a soul on board. The risk of being noticed aboard an elevator full of consumers was too high, so Yuna believed her best hope lay in borrowing a child and using his soul to make an otherwise empty elevator convey her to freedom. You sound very sure of your thesis. If my experiences do not give me the right to be sure, whose do? The events that followed I need not recount. Nonetheless, please describe the Yuna 939 atrocity as you saw it. Very well. The child's mother saw her son in Yuna's arms as the elevator doors closed. She screamed, A clone's taken my boy. A chain reaction of hysteria began. Trays were flung, shakes spilled, Sonys dropped. Some diners believed the earthquake cushioning had malfunctioned and dived under the tables. An off-duty enforcer unholstered his Colt, waded into the heart of the turmoil and bellowed for order. He fired a sonic shot, ill-advisedly in a sealed space, causing many to believe terrorists were firing on consumers. I remember seeing Sierre emerge from his office, slip on a spilled drink, and vanish under a swell of customers now stampeding for the elevator. Many were injured in this crush. Aide Cho was yelling into his hand, Sony. I could not hear what. Rumors ricocheted around the dome. A Yuna had kidnapped a boy. No, a baby. No, a pureblood had kidnapped a Yuna. An enforcer had shot a boy. No, a fabricant had hit the seer whose nose was bleeding. All the while, Papa Song served noodle waves on his plinth. Then someone shouted that the elevator was descending, and silence seized the dinery as quickly as panic had, less than a minute before. The enforcer shouted for space, crouched and aimed at the doors. The crush of consumers cleared in an instant. The elevator reached the dinery and its doors opened. The boy was quivering, balled into one corner. His sailor suit was no longer white. Perhaps my last memory in the lighthouse will be Yuna 939's body, turned into a pulp of bullet holes. That image is burned into every pureblood memory too, Sonmi. When I got home that night, my dorm mates were glued to the Sony. Half of Neo Socopus's New Year festivities were cancelled. The other half was decidedly muted. Media alternated footage from the in-dinery Nikon with the Changmyo Plaza public order Nikon, showing the passing enforcer neutralize Yuna 939. We couldn't believe what we were seeing. We were sure a Union terrorist had face-scaped herself to look like a server for twisted propaganda purposes. When unanimity confirmed the fabricant was a genuine Yuna, You felt the corporocratic world order had changed, irrevocably. You vowed never to trust any fabricant. You knew that abolitionism was as dangerous and insidious a dogma as unionism. You supported the resultant homeland laws dictated by the beloved chairman wholeheartedly. All of those, yes. What happened down in your dinery, meanwhile? Unanimity arrived in force to blip every diner's soul and to Nikon eyewitnesses' accounts as the dome was evacuated. We cleaned the dinery and imbibed soap without vespers. The following yellow-up, my sister's memories of Yuna 939's killing, remained largely intact. That matins, instead of the customary starring ceremony, Papa Song delivered his anti-union sermon. I still find it incredible that a logo man told his fabricants about union. Such was the shock, the panic. Doubtless the sermon's primary goal was to show media that the Papa Song Corp had a damage control strategy in place. Papa Song's upstrata lexicon that matins supports this theory. It was quite a performance. Would you recount what you remember for my orison? Our logo man's head filled half the dome, so we seemed to stand inside his mind. His clownish expression was heavy with grief and rage, and his clown's voice rang with despair. The Hwasuns trembled, the aides looked odd, and Siori was pasty and sick. Papa Song told us a gas called evil exists in the world. Purebloods called terrorists breathe in this evil, and this gas makes them hate all that is free, orderly, good, and corporocratic. A group of terrorists called Union had caused yesterday's atrocity by infecting one of our own sisters, Yuna 939 of the Changmyo Plaza Dinery, with evil. Instead of judicing Union, Yuna 939 had let the evil take her into temptation and deviance, and were it not for the dedication of unanimity, with whom Papa Song Corp had always fully cooperated, a consumer's innocent son would now be dead. The boy had survived, but Diner's trust in our beloved Corp had been wounded grievously. The challenge before us, Papa Song concluded, was to work harder than ever to earn back that trust. Therefore, we must be vigilant against evil, every minute of every day. This new catechism was more important than all the others. If we obeyed, our Papa would love us forever. If we failed to obey, Papa would zero-star us year after year, and we would never get to exaltation. Did we understand? My sister's understanding would have been hazy at best. Our logoman had used many words we did not know. Nevertheless, cries of, "Yes, Papa Song," echoed throughout the plinth. "I cannot hear you," our logoman exhorted us. "Yes, Papa Song," every server and every dinery in Corpocracy shouted. "Yes, Papa Song." As I said, quite a performance. "You said in your trial that Una 939 couldn't have been a Union member. Do you still maintain that position?" "Yes." "How and when could Union recruit her? Why would a Union man risk the exposure? Of what worth was a genome server to a terrorist ring?" "I'm puzzled. If amnesiads in soap nullify memory, how come you can recall the events of that time with such precision and clarity?" "Because my own ascension had already begun. Even to a thoroughbred imbecile like Boom Sook, the degradation of Una 939's neurochemical stability was obvious, so another guinea pig was being prepared. The amnesiads in my soap sack were reduced accordingly, and ascension catalysts in-streamed." "So, after the sermon, New Year's Day was business as usual?" "Business, yes. Usual, no. The starring ceremony was perfunctory. 2 12 stars were escorted into the elevator by aide An. These were replaced by 2 Kylims. Una 939 was replaced by a new Una. CRE inserted our new stars into our collars in grave silence. Applause was deemed inappropriate. Soon after, media streamed in, flashing Nikons and besieging the office. Our seer could get them out only by first letting them Nikon the new Una, lying in the elevator with a 939 sticker on her collar, covered in tomato sauce. Later, unanimity medics examined each of us in turn. I was frightened of incriminating myself, but only my birthmark provoked any passing comment."
"Your birthmark? I didn't know fabricants have birthmarks."
"We do not, so mine always caused me embarrassment in the steamer. Ma Lu Da 108 called it Sanmi 451 stain."
"Would you show it to my Orison, just as a curio?"
"If you wish. Here, between my collarbone and shoulder blade."
"Extraordinary. It looks like a comet, don't you think?"
Heju Im made exactly the same remark, curiously.
"Huh. Well, coincidences happen. Did Siori retain his position?"
"Yes, but it brought the unlucky man little solace. He reminded his corp execs how he had smelled deviance on Una 939 months before, thus passing blame to the medic who examined her. Changmyo Plaza profits soon returned to average levels. Purebloods have short memories where their stomachs are concerned. Kylim 689 and Kylim 889 were a further attraction. As a newly created stem type, they drew queues of fabricant spotters."
"And it was around this time that you grew aware of your own ascension?"
"Correct. You wish me to describe the experience?" "It mirrored Una 939's I now recognize. Firstly, a voice spoke in my head. It alarmed me greatly until I learned that no one else could hear this voice, known to purebloods as sentience. Secondly, my language evolved. For example, if I meant to say good, my mouth substituted a finer-tuned word such as favorable, pleasing, or correct. In a climate where purebloods throughout the 12 cities were reporting fabricant deviations at the rate of thousands a week, this was a dangerous development, and I sought to curtail it. Thirdly, my curiosity about all things grew acute. The hunger Una 939 had spoken of. I eavesdropped Diner's Sony's, Advi, Boardman's speeches, anything to learn. I too yearned to see where the elevator led. Nor did the fact that 2 fabricants working side by side on the same teller in the same dinery, both experienced these radical mental changes, evade me. Lastly, my sense of alienation grew.
Amongst my sisters, I alone understood our existence's futility and drudgery. I even woke during curfew, but never entered the secret room, or even dared move until yellow up. Yuna's doubts about Papa's song haunted me. Ah, I envied my uncritical, unthinking sisters. But most of all, I was afraid. How long did you endure that state?
Some months. Until the ninth night of the last week of fourth month, specifically. I woke during curfew to a faint sound of breaking glass. My sisters were all dorming. Only Siori was in the dome at such an hour. Time passed. Curiosity defeated my fear, finally, and I opened the dorm room door. Across the dome, our seer's office was open. Ri lay in lamplight, face flat against the floor, his chair upended. I crossed the dinery. Blood leaked from his eyes and nostrils, and a used soap sack was crumpled on the desk. Seer did not have the color of the living.
Ri was dead. An overdose.
Whatever the official verdict, the office stunk of soap soporifics. A server usually imbibes 3 milligrams. Ri appeared to have taken a quarter-liter sack, so suicide seems a reasonable conclusion. I face a grand quandary. If I sonied for a medic, perhaps I could save my seer's life. But how to explain my intervention? Healthy fabricants, as you know, never wake during curfew. Bleak as the life of an ascending fabricant was, the prospect of reorientation was bleaker.
You said you envied your unthinking, untroubled sisters.
That is not quite the same as wishing to be one. I returned to my cot.
That decision didn't cause you any guilt later?
Not much. Rhee's decision was his own. But I had a foreboding that the night's events were not yet over, and sure enough, when yellow up came, my sisters stayed in their cots. The air carried no scent of stimulant, and no aide had reported for work. I discerned the sound of a Sony being used. Wondering if Siori had somehow recovered, I left the dorm room and looked into the dome. A man in a dark suit sat there. He had tubed himself a coffee and watched me watching him across the dinery. He spoke finally.
Good morning, Sonmi 451. I hope you're feeling better today than Siori.
He sounds like an enforcer. The man introduced himself as Chang, a chauffeur. I apologized, I did not know the word. A chauffeur, the soft-spoken visitor explained, drives Fords for execs and boardmen, but sometimes serves as a messenger too. He, Mr. Chang, had a message for me, Sonmi 451, from his own seer. This message was in fact a choice. I could leave the dinery now and repay my investment outside, or else stay where I was, wait for unanimity and their DNA sniffers to come, and investigate the death of Siori, and be exposed as a Union spy.
Not much of a choice.
No. I had no possessions to pack or farewells to make. In the elevator, Mr. Chang pressed a panel. As the doors closed on my old life, my only life, I could not begin to imagine what waited above me. My torso squashed my suddenly feeble legs. I was supported by Mr. Chang, who said every inside fabricant experiences the same nausea the first time. Yuna 939 must have dropped the boy as she underwent the same mechanical ascension in that same elevator. To damn the unpleasantness, I found myself recalling scenes from Yuna's broken Sony. The cobweb streams, gnarled towers, the unnamed wonders. As the elevator slowed, my torso seemed to rise disorientingly. Mr. Chang announced, "Ground level," and the doors opened on outside.
"I almost envy you. Please, describe exactly what you saw."
Changmyo Plaza, pre-dawn. Cold. I had never known cold. How vast it seemed, yet the plaza cannot be more than 500 meters across. Around the feet of the beloved chairman, consumers hurried. Walkway sweepers droned. Taxis buzzed riders. Inching Fords fumed. Crawling trash trucks churned.
throughways 8 lanes wide, lined by sun poles, ducks rumbling underfoot, neonized logos blaring, sirens, engines, circuitry, new light of new intensities at new angles.
It must have been overwhelming.
Even the smells were new after the diner's scented airflow. Kimchi, Ford fumes, sewage. A running consumer missed me by a centimeter, shouted, "Watch where you're standing, you Democrat and clone," and was gone. My hair stirred in the breath of a giant invisible fan, and Mr. Chang explained how the streets funnel the morning wind to high speeds. He steered me across the walkway to a mirrored Ford. Three young men admiring the vehicle disappeared as we approached, and the rear door hissed open. The chauffeur ushered me inside and closed the door. I crouched. A bearded passenger slouched in the roomy interior, working on his Sony. He exuded authority. Mr. Chang sat in front, and the Ford edged into traffic. I saw Papa Song's golden arches recede into 100 other corp logos, and a new city of symbols slid by, most entirely new. When the Ford braked, I lost my balance, and the bearded man mumbled that no one would object if I sat down. I apologized for not knowing the right catechism here, and intoned, "My caller is Sonmi 451, as taught in orientation." The passenger just rubbed his red eyes and asked Mr. Chang for a weather report. I do not recall what the chauffeur said, only that the Ford jams were bad, and the bearded man looking at his Rolex and cursing the slowness.
"Didn't you ask where you were being taken?"
Why ask a question whose answer would demand 10 more questions? Remember, archivist, I had never seen an exterior, nor experienced conveyance. Yet there I was, throughweighing Nia Socopros's second biggest conurb. I was less a cross-zone tourist, more a time traveler from a past century. The Ford cleared the urban canopy near Moon Tower, and I saw my first dawn over the Kangwon-do Mountains. I cannot describe what I felt. The imminent chairman's one true sun, its molten light, petrol clouds, his dome of sky. To my further astonishment, the bearded passenger was dozing. Why did the entire conurb not grind to a halt and give praise in the face of such ineluctable beauty?
What else caught your eye?
Oh, the greenness of green. Back under the canopy, our Ford slowed by a dew garden between squatting buildings. Feathery, fronded, moss-drenched green. In the dinery, the sole samples of green were chlorophyll squares and diners' clothes, so I assumed it was a precious, rare substance. Therefore, the dew garden and its rainbow sleeving along the Fordway astounded me. East, dorm blocks lined the throughway, each adorned by the corporocratic flag, until the waysides fell away and we passed over a wide, winding, ordure-brown strip, empty of Fords. I summoned up courage to ask Mr. Chang what it might be. The passenger answered, "Han River, Songsu Bridge." I could only ask, what were these things?
"Water, a throughway of water."
Tiredness and disappointment flattened his voice.
"Oh, notch up another wasted early morning, Chang."
I was confused by the difference between water in the dinery and the river's sludge. Mr. Chang indicated the low peak ahead. "Mount Taemosan, Sonmi, your new home."
"So you were taken to the university straight from Papa Song's?"
"To reduce experimental contamination, yes. The road upzigged through woodland, trees, their incremental gymnastics and noisy silence. Yes, and their greenness still mesmerize me." Soon we arrived on the plateau campus. Cuboid buildings clustered. Young purebloods paced narrow walkways where litter drifted and lichen yeasted. The Ford coasted to a halt under a rain-stained, sun-cracked overhang. Mr. Chang led me into a lobby, leaving the bearded passenger to doze in the Ford. Mount Taemosan's high air tasted clean, but the lobby was grimed and unlit. We paused at the foot of a double helix staircase. "This is an old-style elevator," Mr. Chang explained.
The university exercises students' bodies as well as their minds. So I battled gravity for the first time, step by step, grasping the handrail. Two students descended the downhelix, laughing at my clumsiness. One commented, "That specimen won't be making a bid for freedom any time soon." Mr. Chang warned me not to look over my shoulder. I did so foolishly, and vertigo tipped me over. Had my guide not caught me, I would have fallen. It took several minutes to ascend to the sixth floor, the topmost. Here a slitted corridor ended at a door, slightly ajar, nameplated Boom Suk Kim. Mr. Chang knocked, but no answer came. "Wait in here for Mr. Kim," the chauffeur told me. "Obey him as a seer." I entered and turned to ask Mr. Chang what work I should do, but the chauffeur had gone. I was quite alone for the first time in my life. "What did you think of your new quarters?" "Dirty. Our diner, you see, was always spotless. The catechisms preach cleanliness. Boom Suk Kim's lab was, in contrast, a long gallery, rancid with pure-blood male odor. Bins overflowed. A crossbow target hung by the door. The walls were lined with lab benches, buried desks, obsolete Sonys, and sagging bookshelves. A framed Kodak of a smiling boy and a dead, bloodied snow leopard hung over the only desk to show evidence of use. A filthy window overlooked a neglected courtyard, where a mottled figure stood on a plinth. I wondered if he was my new logo man, but he never stirred. In a cramped anteroom I found a cot, a hygiener, and a sort of portable steam cleaner. When was I to use it? What catechisms governed my life in this place? A fly buzzed lazy figures of eight. So ignorant was I of outside, I even wondered if the fly might be an aide, and introduced myself to it.
Had you never seen insects before?
Only rogue-jeaned roaches and dead ones. Papa Song's aircon inflows insecticide, so if any enter via the elevator, they die instantly. The fly hit the window over and over. I did not then know windows open. Indeed, I did not know what a window was. Then I heard off-key singing, a pop song about Phnom Penh girls. Moments later, a student in beach shorts, sandals, and silk, weighed down by shoulder bags, kickboxed the door open. Upon seeing me, he groaned, "What in the name of holy corpocracy are you doing here?" I bared my collar. "Sum me 451, sir. Papa Song's server from..." "Shut up, shut up. I know what you are." The young man had a froggish mouth and the hurt eyes then in vogue. "But you're not supposed to be here until fifth day. If those registry dildos expect me to cancel a 5-star Taiwanese conference just because they can't read calendars... Well, sorry, they can suck maggots in an Ebola pit. I only came in to pick up my work Sony and discs. I'm not babysitting any experimental clone still in uniform when I could be sinning myself sticky in Taipei." The fly hit the window again. The student picked up a pamphlet and pushed past me. The whack made me jump. He inspected the smear with a laugh of triumph. "Let that be a warning to you. Nobody double-crosses Boom Suk Kim. Now... don't touch anything, don't go anywhere. Soap's in the box fridge. Bank chairman, they delivered your feed early. I'll be back late on sixth day. If I don't leave for the airport now, I'll miss my flight." He went, then reappeared in the doorway. "You can talk, can't you?" I nodded. "Bank chairman. Fact, for every moronity, there's 10 registry clone bones somewhere committing it as we speak."
"What were you supposed to do for the next 3 days?"
Except watch the Rolex hand erode the hours. I had no idea. It was no major hardship. Servers are genomed for grueling 19-hour workdays. I passed idle hours wondering if Mrs. Rhee was a grieving widow or a glad one. Would Aide An or Aide Cho be promoted to Chongmyo Plaza Seer? Already the diary seemed impossibly distant. From the courtyard I heard pins and needles of sound, from shrubs mobbing the plinth. Thus I first encountered birds. An arrow overflew, and many hundreds of swallows poured upstream. For whom did they sing? Their logo man? The beloved chairman? The sky curfewed, and the room darkened for my first night on the surface.
I felt lonely, but nothing worse. Windows across the courtyard yellowed up, showing labs like Boom Sook's, housing young purebloods, neater offices occupied by professors, busy corridors, vacant ones. I did not see a single fabricant. At midnight, I felt toxed and imbibed a sap of soap, lay in the cot, and wished Una 939 was there to make sense of the day's legion mysteries.
Did your second day outside provide any answers?
Some, but yet more surprises. The first stood across the anteroom from my cot as I awoke, a pylonic man over 3 meters tall and dressed in an orange zip suit, was studying the bookshelves. His face, neck, and hands were scalded red, burnt black, and patched pale, but he did not seem to suffer pain. His collar confirmed he was a fabricant, but I could not guess his stem type. Lips genomed out, ears protected by horn valves, and a voice deeper than any I heard before or since.
No stimulant here. You wake when you wake. Especially if your postgrad is as lazy as Boom Sook Kim. Exec postgrads are the worst. They have their asses wiped for them, from kindergarten to euthanasium.
With a giant two-thumbed hand, he indicated a blue zip suit half the size of his. For you, little sister. As I changed from my Papa Song's uniform into my new garment, I asked if he had been sent by a seer.
No seers either, said the burnt giant. Your postgrad and mine are friends. Boom Sook called yesterday, complained about your unexpected delivery. I wished to visit you pre-curfew, but genome surgery postgrads work late, unlike slackers here in psychogenomics. I'm Wing 027. Let's find out why you're here.
Wing 027 sat on Boom Sook's desk and switched on the Sony, ignoring my protest that my postgrad had forbidden me to touch it. Wing clicked the screenboard. Una 939 appeared. Wing trailed his finger along the rows of words.
Let's pray to the imminent chairman. Boom Sook doesn't make that error again.
I asked Wing could he read. Wing said if a randomly assembled pureblood can read, a well-designed fabricant should learn with ease. Soon a Sonmi appeared on the Sony. My collar 451 circled her neck. Here, said Wing, and read slowly. In dorm room, cerebral upsizing, the service fabricant. A feasibility case study on Sonmi 451 by Boom Sook Kim. Why, Wing muttered, is a no-brainer exec postgrad aiming so high?
What sort of fabricant was Wing 027? A militiaman?
No, a disaster man. He boasted he could operate in deadlands so infected or radioactive that purebloods perished there like bacteria in bleach, that his brain had only minor genomic refinements, and that disaster men's basic orientation provides a more thorough education than most pureblood universities. Finally, he bared his hideously burnt forearm.
Show me a pureblood who could stand this. My postgrad's PhD is tissue flame-proofing.
Wing 027's explanation of deadlands appalled me, but the disaster man anticipated their approach with relish. The day when all Neosokopros is deadlanded, he told me, will be the day fabricants become the new purebloods. This sounded deviant, and besides, if these deadlands were so widespread in the world, I asked, why had I not seen them from the Ford? Wing 027 asked me how big I believed the world to be. I was unsure, but I said I had been driven all the way from Changmyo Plaza to this mountain, so I must have seen most of it, surely. The giant told me to follow, but I hesitated. Boom Sook had ordered me not to leave the room. Wing 027 warned me, Sonmi 451, you must create catechisms of your own, and slung me over his shoulder, carried me along the slitted corridor, around a tight corner, and up a dusty spiral staircase, where he fisted open a rusty door. Morning sunlight blinded, brisk wind slapped, and air grit stung my face. The disaster man set me down. On the roof of the psychogenomics faculty, I gripped the railing and gasped. 6 levels down was a cactus garden, birds hunting insects in the needles. Further down the mountain, a Ford park half full. Further, a sports track circumbed by a regiment of students. Below that, a consumer plaza. Beyond that, woods sloping down to the spilled, tarred, and neon conurb. High-rises, dorm blocks, the Han River. Finally, mountains lining the arrow-scored sunrise. A big view, I remember Wing's soft, burnt voice. But held against the whole world, Somme 451, all you see is a chip of stone. My mind fumbled with such enormity and dropped it. How could I understand such a limitless world? Wing replied, I needed intelligence. Ascension would provide this. I needed time. Boomsuk Kim's idleness would give me time. However, I also needed knowledge. I asked, how is knowledge found? You must learn how to read, little sister, said Wing 027. So, Wing 027, not Heiju Im or Boardman Nephi, mentored you first. That is not true, strictly. Our second meeting was our final one. The disaster man returned to Boomsuk's lab an hour before curfew to give me an unlost Sony, preloaded with every autodidact module in Upstrata Corpocracy schooling. He showed me its operation, then warned me never to let a pureblood catch me gathering knowledge, for the sight scares them, and there is nothing a scared pureblood will not do. By Boomsuk's return from Taiwan on sixth day, I had mastered the Sony's usage and graduated from virtual elementary school. By sixth month, I completed exec secondary school. You looked skeptical, archivist, but remember what I said about Ascendant's hunger for information. We are only what we know, and I wish to be much more than I was, sorely. I didn't mean to look skeptical, Sonmi. Your mind, speech, yourself show your dedication to learning. What confuses me is, why did Boomsuk Kim give you so much time to study? An exec heir surely was no covert abolitionist. What about his PhD experiments on you? Boomsuk Kim's concerns were not his PhD, but drinking, gambling, and his crossbow. His father was an exec on Kwangju Genomics, lobbying for a boardmanship on the Juche, until his son made such an influential enemy. With such an upstrata father, study was a mere formality. But how was Boomsuk planning to graduate? By paying an academic agent to collate his thesis from the agent's own sources. A common practice. The Ascension neurochemicals were pre-formulated for him, with yields and conclusions. Boomsuk himself could not have identified the biomolecular properties of toothpaste. In 9 months, my experimental duties never exceeded cleaning his lab and preparing his tea. Fresh data might cloud those he had bought and risk exposing him as a fraud, you see. So during my postgrad's long absences, I could study without risk of discovery. Wasn't Boomsuk Kim's tutor aware of this outrageous plagiarism? Professors who value tenure do not muckrake the sons of future Juche boardmen. Did Boomsuk never even talk to you, interact with you in any way? He addressed me like pureblood speak to a cat. It amused him to pose me questions he fancied were incomprehensible. Hey, 451, is it worth azuring my teeth, do you reckon, or is sapphire just a passing fad this season? He did not expect cogent answers. I did not disabuse his expectations. My reply became so habitual, Boomsuk nicknamed me, I do not know, sir, 451. So for 9 months, nobody observed your skyrocketing sentience. So I believed. Boomsuk Kim's only regular visitors were Min Sik and Fang. Fang's real name was never used in my hearing. They bragged about their new Suzukis and played poker, and paid no attention to fabricants outside Hwam Dong Gil comfort hives. Gil Soo Noon, Boomsuk's neighbor, a downstrata postgrad on scholarship aid, banged on the wall to complain about the noise from time to time, but the three execs banged back louder. I saw him only once or twice. What is poker? A card game where abler liars take money off less able liars. Fang won thousands of credits from Boomsuk and Min Sik's souls during their poker sessions. Other times, the three students indulged in drugs, often soap. On these occasions, Boomsuk told me to get out. When toxed, he complained, clones disturbed him. I would go to the faculty roof, sit in the water tank shade, and watch swifts hunt giant gnats until dark, when I knew the three postgrads would be gone.